WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work offers a one-year advanced standing option for students with a bachelor's degree in social work that builds on prior training and connects students with expert faculty and 5 specialized pathways. Apply by February 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. If you're looking for a textbook on lyrical mastery and storytelling, look no further than Chicago's own Lupe Fiasco. We're listening to Samurai off his latest album with the same name. The Grammy-winning rapper, producer, and songwriter helped usher in a new wave of hip-hop in Chicago and is as versatile as artists come. And on top of deep lyrics on the Samurai album, Lupe explores the stoic discipline of a warrior by way of the classic art form of battle rapping. Lupe Fiasco joined me in the studio to discuss the album, his lifelong affiliation with martial arts, and much more. Let's get to the conversation. So you're back home in Chicago on the Samurai tour. Many of us know the word samurai, and we know it comes from Japan and it means warrior. But your introduction to these fighters...
Don't mean warrior.
It doesn't?
Nah, it doesn't mean warrior.
What does it mean?
Samurai means to serve.
To serve?
Bushi is warrior.
Bushi is warrior.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've had a misconception then for a long time.
Yeah. It's cool. We had to clear it up.
But your introduction to Japanese terms like these did not come from that country. It came from your dad, from your father.
Yeah, it came from my father.
Yeah, so tell us about Sensei Gregory Jaco, how he got started and your upbringing with him.
Yeah, my father was born in Chicago. Grew up in the Robert Taylor homes on the South Side. When they first was open, when they first started, when they was like a nice, when they weren't the projects, you know, it was like a housing development.
Right.
And the story goes, he learned martial arts through a mix of kung fu films, little kind of dojo visits, different teachers and different instructors who had little programs in the city, the Japanese Cultural Institute, Master Shin, who had a brand called Bear Brand and had a store based in Chicago called East West Market Exchange. But anyway, my dad learned martial arts when he was about like 14 and quickly kind of consumed his life, amongst other things. But he was a myriad guy, musician, military guy, special forces, whole array of things. But it was always a foundation of the martial arts underneath that. He was an inventor, did some other stuff. I don't want to get too much into his bio. But so he started training and then started teaching and then had a little dojo called Tiger Dojo, I think was the first one. And it was like in a community center somewhere. And he was literally fighting like the gangs, like the burgeoning little gangs that were in the projects at that time. So they were like
your father was amazing.
Yeah, it was a lot. So that went into... you know, him starting schools, doing martial arts in the military.
So was he teaching you at the same time?
So I didn't come into the scene until 1982. So this is all back in like the 60s, 70s.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so multiple schools, multiple different types of schools with different pieces. One's called Black Dragon Slayers. The school that I came into when I was born was called Tornado. And that was on 67th and Stony Island. And then we had another school on the west side. And then just my entire life is karate schools, martial arts programs, demonstrations, getting beat up, all types of stuff. Getting beat up by my dad, not getting beat up by people.
Not by other people.
Not on the streets, yeah.
Wow, that's pretty cool. And earlier this week, you know, speaking of his legacy, on Veterans Day, you got together with members of Chicago's African American martial arts community.
Yeah.
You guys got together to honor his legacy.
Yeah.
Right? He's also received recognition from Cook County.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. So, I mean, why do you think it's important then to continue the legacy of black karate movement?
Well, black martial arts is, you know, not just karate, black martial arts. So Chinese martial arts. My father was a judo expert, was training to be world champion back in the 80s. Taekwondo, Korean martial arts. So just the array of martial arts. Kendo, Aikido, all these different pieces. And everybody that we came into contact with, for the most part, except for maybe one or two people, everybody was black. You know, all of the instructors, all of the sister schools, the partner schools, the programs, the people we taught, the neighborhoods we were in, everybody was black. To see a white person come into our school was like, or to see like an Asian person or Master Shin would come and visit, would go to the store, like, you know.
That was shocking for you.
Shocking for us. But everybody that was in our program was black. So for me, it wasn't a separate thing. You know, it was like, this is also black culture. Mm-hmm. You know, in our karate school, martial arts school, had a Japanese, I'm not Japanese, an African drum dance center across the hall, you know? So it was like, we're everywhere we turned, it was like black culture,
this
African
culture. This was embedded within your community and the spaces that you took up.
Yeah, so I bring that up to get to the point about like the legacy. My dad has always been recognized for this. One of the earliest pictures that we have was with Mayor Harold Washington, where he brought a bunch of the black martial arts, and this is back when I was like three, so this is like 85, 86, something like that, where he brought all of the black martial artists at the time, including my dad, and did a whole thing down at City Hall. And, you know, my dad has always kind of been recognized for having those community, like he would come in that same energy where he would be in the projects and fighting off the gangs. Whenever he opened up a karate school or a martial arts program somewhere, he would open it up like in, I won't call it like the worst neighborhoods, but gang infested, drugs, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then like a few days before he would open, he would send his ninjas out into the community to like basically tell the drug dealers and gangbangers, like, look, when class is in session, y'all can't do nothing around.
Get out of here.
You know?
Yeah.
So from a community standpoint, and then just being recognized, you know, at the municipal level and at the county level is something that, you know, we're not strangers to, but it's good to see.
Now, do you have a black belt? Is that right?
Or
is
that a rumor? Yeah. I got like four, I think.
You got like four. I remember it was like 6 or 7 years ago, you would post videos on Instagram just kind of showing off like your sword handling skills, right? I remember that was the first time that sort of came to my attention. And I was like, okay, what is going on here?
Yeah.
There's some other talents happening. I think of black belt training, and from what I know, which is not very much, it requires dedication in so many ways, right? I have my dad's brother, an uncle of mine also has a few black belts, and I just remember seeing him just be incredibly focused. It's a highly competitive, it's got a highly competitive nature. So I wonder how you translate some of that, that discipline into hip hop.
Well, to on the black belt side, is different programs and different schools and different systems have different like things that you need to accomplish to receive a black belt.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is easy compared to other schools, but not in terms of like you just 6 months and we give you a black belt. It's just that the things you have to do, like you might have to learn like a few forms, you know, and know a few pieces of terminology, do a little combat training thing, and then that's enough to kind of push you over to like black belt. Other schools, it's a time limit, like it's 10 years. Like you're not, no matter what you do, you're not eligible to get black for 10 years. My dad's system, and he kind of went through all of them.
Yeah.
But the system that he kind of landed on, at least with us, was it was about the character of who you are. And then if you were able to, whatever everybody's journey was different. So it's like that thing that was holding you back, when you were able to kind of push through that, that made you eligible for at least to be considered to kind of go up for your black belt promotions and stuff like that. So it wasn't like this real static system of like, well, you had to know this whole set of forms, you had to do this. Like you could do that, you know? And one of the things my dad school was about, and this is all kind of going to this, the hip hop question, right? Is like, you came to our school and what you learn on Tuesday, you might be doing Japanese karate on Tuesday. Thursday, you might be doing Taekwondo, you know, Korean martial arts.
Which is
and then
different.
Saturday, we might be doing like a mix of like wushu and tai chi and all these other things. My father always wanted our particular program, our Tornado School of Martial Arts, was to be varied and introduce you to a lot of things, right? And then you kind of picked like, oh, I really like Aikido or whatever that thing was for you that you excelled at, right? It's like, okay, chase that. And then he would like say, hey, if you really want to learn that now deeply, go to Japan. You know, if you really want to learn that deeply, here's this school over here. If you really want to learn this deeply, go to China. So for him, he was always looked at as like, I'm going to get you to a certain point, And then beyond that, it's your kind of journey to go. So for me, through all of that, it was that diversity of different things that kind of, the class was never the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never want to make the same song twice. You know, like I can accomplish anything. You know, there's nothing like give them the mic and just put them in front of a group of strangers. Like, let's go. Because when we were kids, we were walking on nail boards. You know, we were running across hot coals, or we're doing like these other jumping through windows and doing stuff like that. So this
is a piece of cake. Yeah,
literally.
And I can hear that in your sound. I'm so interested in what you just said. And I'm thinking now of your latest album, Samurai.
To serve.
Not warrior.
Okay, cool.
You said somewhere that it's inspired by a voicemail of Amy Winehouse.
Hello, that was Amy. Salami, I keep coming out with all battle raps and they're just pouring out of me. I'm a samurai. But I keep coming out with all this.
Where she's telling producer Salam Remy that she's been writing battle rap style music or battle rap style rhymes.
Mm-hmm.
And she's become a lyrical samurai. So tell me more about what it was in that message that caught your attention.
I think it was pandemic days watching, I think it's called Amy. That might be it.
Yes, I think so. The documentary.
And there's a scene in the documentary. And it's a few scenes where it's like, it'll just like pivot to her leaving, playing a voicemail back amidst some other things. And so one of the voicemails was her leaving the voicemail for Slime Ram. He was like, hey, I keep coming up these Wu-Tang battle raps. And if you want to have a battle rap off, you know, come on, cause I'm gonna kill you. Cause I'm a samurai. And for me, it was like, oh snap. Like, oh, yo, pin that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's a song that needs like, what would happen if she, so at first it started as kind of like, of course, being a fan of Amy Winehouse, rest in peace.
Yes.
And just her as a writer, you know, her as a performer. And then knowing she always had this relationship to kind of hip hop in a certain way. And it was kind of like, oh, yeah, okay. Well, what if she was a battle rapper? You know, what would that sound like?
Mm.
And it initially just started as one song, which is the title track, Samurai. And then that was going to be it, just this portrait of Amy and done. And then it was kind of like, oh, how did she learn how to battle rap?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, oh, she got this magical touch from this random dude in the park who was like, yo, now she can't do nothing but rap. It's like, oh, did she go to a battle? So it's like, okay, that's one song. That's another song. That's another song.
So it goes from being just one song to an album.
You start asking
album.
Questions. Yeah. And it's kind of like, and then we kind of put it aside. And my partner, Chill, he had just came home from prison and was like, we got in the studio and I was like, yo, I'm going to play you all the projects I'm sitting on. And I played them to Amy Winehouse. And the first thing he said was like, yeah, let's do that one.
Yeah.
So there you go.
So much of your work is conceptual. So you've got this Amy Winehouse as a battle rapper and samurai.
Mm-hmm.
You've got your entire storyline of Michael Young history in your album, The Cool.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And exploring, you know, what happens if Africans put on slave ships could survive underwater.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And dedicated their lives to sinking other slave ships in Droga's wave. So have there been other ideas that you've had that maybe seemed even a little too out there or far-fetched for you?
For me, like crazy ideas? Nah, actually,
I
mean,
you just talked about all that diversity. So now I'm thinking, is anything too far-fetched for Lupe Fiasco?
Not really. I've done records about, I mean, because you know, I've been rapping since I was 14, you know, professionally since I was 18. I got my first record deal when I was still in high school, kind of a thing.
Wow.
And so you fast forward all the way now to now I'm 42. I've been rapping for 25, 26
long
years.
Time.
So you never want to do the same thing twice. So I've already exhausted all of the basic stuff, like all that's done. So now it's like these bigger leaps, more interesting things, more collaborative things. Anything that kind of inspires the story. And for me, it's like, you don't know where that's going to come from. So I'm constantly open and I can't live like a rich man's life. I have to get on like the train and like, because there's a story there potentially,
mm-hmm.
you know, on the subway, you know? And so it's like, yo, why is Lupe on the subway? It's like, because I'm trying to find something to rap about. You know what I'm saying? Mind your business, right?
That's where things happen.
Indeed. So I find myself like trying to find mundane things that are profound, right? So they find this balance where the common, ordinary person can relate to it, but it's referencing or looking at something that is very, very much so unique and novel in those experiences. And sometimes it works, you know, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's not enough material to build a complete story. So mm-hmm. a lot of those stories are like somewhat unfinished, even Samurai is unfinished.
Oh.
because it's kind of like you start to run out of material. Mm. You're just kind of, all right, we're done. Let me wait like a few years. So
we'll get the continuation later on.
I don't think
perhaps.
So. I don't think so. I think it's something to leave things kind of undone. There's a magic.
I like that strategy.
So one project that I'm working on, I've been writing it now for maybe 15 years. It's called Skulls, and it was meant to be like my last album.
Yeah.
And that is still like a crazy work in progress with all type of random. There's like a woman who's a murder psychic in it. It's like, it's super wild extra things.
But one day you'll get the inspiration to
maybe not
finish it.
Maybe not. There's a joy in that too. Like,
we'll
to just
to
kind of be
see. Joy for you or joy for us?
Joy for me.
As the fans.
Yeah. I stopped worrying about the fans a long time ago. I still got fans. What are we doing? Oh, anyway, no.
Of course you do. Joking. With that, let's hear another track off Samurai. This is Cake.
I've won many things I've done, but this one here, this one takes the cake.
This one takes the cake.
I've won many things I've done, but this one here, this one takes the cake.
Compliments on my accomplishments are only possible due to your involvement. Volume of your confidence, a consequence of stimulating your consciousness, activating the cognitive structures. I think all you the opposite still play a vital role in my conquering.
So in the lyrics for Cake, you say a few times, you say, I've won many things I've done, but this one here, this one takes the cake.
Right.
I want you to say more on that. Describe that feeling of success for us.
Well, it's that one's a little paradoxical because it's coming, that's Amy, you know, a rapper Amy talking, saying that, right? She had just won the battle and this is the celebratory moment. Mm-hmm. Like, this one takes the cake. So there's a, if you implant yourself in a story, it's like celebratory. But if you step back and you look at the entire inspiration of it and actually who it is, and it has a certain melancholy kind of to it. And I always like to play with that duality of opposing things. But just in the story itself, and you know, celebrating your wins, you know, and achieving certain things, it feels good. You know, it has a boost of dopamine in there. You know, I move very differently though in certain ways, where I try not to get too comfortable, especially with things that people give to me, because they can take them away. But I celebrate fully, unapologetically, and this probably gets me in trouble sometimes, the things that I know I did on my own that you can't take from me, you know? And so there's something in that to go a little bit off target a little bit from the song, but just talking about success. What successes do you celebrate?
Yeah.
What successes are you cautious about, right? Because it's a ticking time bomb in certain cases. Like, people kind of test you, give you things. And as much as people like to celebrate you on the way up, they love to celebrate you on the way down.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So I try and keep myself
agile. It's a harsh
truth. Yeah. It's, I would say the F word, but you know, I'm not going to do this publicly.
Not on this family show.
It's family. It's familied up. You know what I'm saying?
That's the F word. Okay.
But no, I mean, it's sometimes you do. Sometimes, like, I leave things on the stage.
Yeah.
Like, it's done. I got to move on.
Now, in the same breath, you don't shy away from calling yourself the best rapper in the industry.
You got to. I don't call myself the best in the, I'm the best lyricist, but I'm not done. So I'm thinking of a point in the future. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do stop and it's time to take account, and that could be 20 years from now, it's that confidence thing to keep going. And then I know, like, my peers, as much as we're friends, we're also very much so in an antagonistical relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still jovial, it's still good.
Mm-hmm.
But when I say that, I'm speaking of a point in the future where I'm like, I'm done. Now let's go over and review my body of work.
So as the best lyricist, I mean, would you say that you feel like you've mastered the art of rapping, or is there still a level that you're trying to reach?
I'm still reaching.
Yeah.
And in order to get there, I have to believe in myself beyond a shadow of a doubt. Because to reach that level of mastery, you can't have any doubt in what you're trying to do. My dad, he ripped it from Star Wars, but it was, he always say, either you do or you don't do. There is no try. So there is no, like, are you the best? No. I'm trying. There is no try. So what are we doing? I'm the best. You establish that. Now prove it. So
here,
I'm in my
proof. So here is
phase.
Some of that martial arts coming over.
Folding back in, right?
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you're 42, but I feel like you have lived a lot of musical lives in that time.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, fortunately. Fortunately. Again, I'm speaking for the fans here. Okay. Fortunately. I mean, we know you for your solo work, and we love it. We know about the big collaborations, of course, all that commercial success with Ye and Jay-Z and Pharrell. Mm. But I have to hear more about this post-punk rock band of yours.
Oh.
Japanese cartoon.
Yeah, Japanese cartoon.
Okay, so before you explain, I want to play a track from the band. Here's Jaws. Okay, so that's a very different sound than what we're used to hearing from you.
Yeah.
How did this come about?
I was watching a documentary about Joy Division. And there's something in that, right? Like, these documentaries about people who have passed. And one of my things is resurrectives. Like, I'm even Drogas Wave, even The Cool. Mm-hmm. There's always this theme of resurrecting things. And I still do it to this day. But I was watching this documentary, and it was about Joy Division, and it was about Ian Curtis. And I was like, that's fire. I want to do that. I want a band like Joy Division. And I started to come up with little bass lines.
It sounds so good.
It is.
And it's
really
funny
is,
for me, like when I first heard it, to like hearing your voice on those kind of beats and hearing all that guitar, I'm like, wait, is this the same person?
So shout out to Graham Burris, who's another member of the of Japanese. It's really me and him and my man Lemessi from Singapore, who comes in from time to time. And we just went in the studio, had these bassline riffs, like Graham played these basslines, and then we just kind of built it, right? And I used my musical sense abilities from being in the music business as a rapper and doing all type of different music spaces. And I was like, yo, let's just make records, you know, that
what
are like
treat.
High energy, you know, that work on stage, that are that have these different elements. So there's some rapping on there. There's some singing. I'm doing British accent in one of them.
Yeah.
Like it's wild.
Can we get more of that? You
Maybe.
Put out one album.
We didn't put it out. Officially put out an album.
I certainly listened to it.
We released like a thing.
Okay.
But it was never on any streaming platforms. And it's back in the day. It's like 2010. So it wasn't on Apple. We didn't do anything with it.
So
the
are
label
we going
turned
to
it down.
Get it officially?
So that first album's called In the Jaws of Lords of Death.
Yes.
And the plan is to hopefully release that soon so the fans can have it.
It's been looming since what, 2010?
2010.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll officially put it out.
Who do I have to call?
Now you talking to him. You're talking to the guy. We're going to put it out.
Well, we'll put it out.
We'll put it out. But it's on YouTube right now. If people want to go check it out, you can go just In the Jaws of the Lords of Death is the name of the album. The band's called Japanese Cartoon. And some fans put up the record, but hopefully it'll be out.
It is super cool.
Before the end of the year, maybe.
Let's get back to the Samurai tour, though, right?
Okay.
So you're in the home stretch. It looks like you have been getting a lot of love on the road. I'm loving everything that you're posting on social. You certainly lit up the crowd at the Salt Shed last weekend. Mm. What is it that you like about performing on stage? Because you are just energetic.
I mean, it varies. Each, you know, there's.
Does it depend on the crowd?
Depends on the crowd. Depends on the venue. Depends on all the things that led up to that moment that day. Depends on who I'm with. Depends on the mood. It's a lot of variables that go into it. The thing that remains standard is, you know, it's the music. The music's going to be there. You just lean into it.
So tell me about rocking to a crowd that's from your hometown. So stage is here in Chicago.
It's kind of unfair. You can't gauge. You can't gauge it. Because like the night before, you'll be in some other person's city and it'll just be like, this is all right, you know. But
and then you come to Chicago.
You come to Chicago
and it's
like
an explosion.
But it's for Chicago, it's special. They're always special, you know, no matter what. And even that night was super special because we got Lupe Fiasco Day.
Yes.
You know, November 10th. So it's always something special and a twist and a thing in Chicago. Some of the things you recognize, like it's very big things. And other things are really subtle, like, yo, such and such came out and performed. you know, that was the first time such and such got on stage and came out and people, but for me, it's like super big where you see Mama Fiasco up in the rafters, like, hey, Mama Fiasco. But, you know, Chicago's always an amazing vibe. You know, they know all the words to the songs, you know, so that works. That helps.
What's it like seeing Mama Fiasco up in the crowd?
She's always good. She's always, you know, chilling. She's about to turn 70.
She's proud, I'm sure.
Yeah, she's happy with everything, you know. Yeah, it's good.
I alluded earlier to the way that you've inspired artists that have come after you. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of, let's stick with Chicagoans, right? I'm thinking of Chance the Rapper. I'm mm-hmm. thinking of Saba. I'm thinking of mm-hmm. No Name. Mm-hmm. How does that feel for you? And I wonder if you, honestly, if you think you get enough credit for your overall impact in our industry.
I don't think that I'm supposed to get credit, you know?
Why
I don't
not?
Think I'm supposed to get the credit. Because I'm still working. You know, I'm still in my craft every day, deeply. And it's not time for credit. You know, credit is kind of like a thing you get at the end. But with that said, I don't want to sound like that's, you know, like the ego or what have you. It's just I need to maintain a sense of I haven't done it yet. You know, I need to maintain a sense of underdogness to what I do, because that is still a fire that pushes me.
That motivation.
Right? To push through and grind. But with that said, those same people, you know, I just seen Vic earlier today, Vic Mensa. Those people have already acknowledged that. I've already seen them. It didn't, it's like for all those folks, it's like, yeah, you. I had another kid walk up to me earlier today too. He's like, yeah, I'm patterning a lot of my stuff based off that. But that's where it's supposed to be.
Nice.
You know, and then there's supposed to be a legion of people who pattern things off of them. And that's how the craft continues to kind of stabilize and, mm-hmm. and stay immortalized in a certain way. But not yet. And I'm cool with that. It's cool. You know, just don't beat me up too much. Like, beating me up is different. You know, but I don't need all the flowers yet.
Yeah. But you're a man of many hats. You recently worked with Google on something called TextFX. You have got to explain this. As far as I understand it, so you created an AI tool for writers.
Rappers. Rappers, comma, writers.
Writers. So I'm curious, because you hear so much pushback on artificial intelligence and all the bad things that's going to do, all the jobs it's going to take away, especially in these creative industries that you and I both work in, the arts. Why did you want to get involved in a project like this?
I mean, so we're venturing into a whole other side of Lupe Fiasco. Right?
I said you wear many hats.
They approached me when I was at MIT, you know, so I'm a professor at MIT, teaching class on rap theory and practice. And, you know, I got a email from somebody at Google and was like, hey, you know, we're working on this project, or we work on a series of projects related to AI as they start to roll out their AI program. So it's like a year and a half ago, something like that. And they're like, hey, if you had access, you know, to a machine learning platform, artificial intelligence platform, what do you want to do? And I was like, I want to mine Bitcoin with it. Can we do that? And I was like, no, we can't do that. That was a joke, ladies and gentlemen. But they was like, yo, I would want to create, I don't want to remove the artist from the process, but I also want to take advantage of what this does, what machine learning and artificial intelligence is really good at, right? Which is efficiency, right? Which is kind of taking things that we think are a part of the grind of the artist, and then we pedestalize it and glorify it. But it's really, we're pedestalizing a certain inefficiency, right? That has that people have already kind of figured out. But so people have rhyming dictionaries. Like, rhyming dictionaries have been around forever.
Yeah.
Right? Poetic practice has been formalized in institutions for hundreds of years, right? It's just something about rap, because it's learned in the wild and it's kind of meant to be so counterculture, counterstructure, that it's like, nah, we got it. Either you got it from the mud or you don't. But then you realize, like, you know, everything's formal in a certain way, right? Everything comes out of some industry or some technological shift, right? Even from DJing to making beats, you know, the core fundamental aspects of hip hop, right? It's technology. It's built on, you know, turntables,
right,
moving from one format to another format, and you're able to be more accurate when you put the needle on the record and it doesn't drift and all that. That's technology. That's some dude in Japan some engineer who's like, maybe we can change this a little bit. And then, you know, some DJs figuring that out and then applying it, and then boom, hip hop, right? So I've never been hesitant to incorporate or approach.
So this
and
is
work
just
with
the
tech.
Next phase.
Yeah,
right?
Just a next.
And is it kind
play.
Of a way to sort of get out in front of this AI technology, if you will, and maybe dispel some of the fears that we have around?
No, not at all. I'm not even looking at it activistly like that, right? It's like, here's some tools that we built. And just so people know, TexFX, it's just a series of tools, little mini tools. Think of like guitar pedals for writing, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's like a simile generator. There's a word parsing tool. There's a scene creation tool. If you type in limousine or fancy limousine at night, it'll take that and generate a bunch of scenes around it to give you different sensories around it. So it's like the smell of the leather. Right. Not that you're going to take that and wholesale plug that into a rap, but through your thought process of trying to establish a scene of like, I'm writing this rap about going to the club in a limousine. What are some things that I may not be observing? Right. Because I'm trying to visualize it. Right. So here's a tool that can help you visualize and make you bring in to make a richer experience. Right.
I see.
That's one tool.
That's
right?
Interesting.
There's 9 tools. It's free. You can use it. You know, it's for rappers
TexFX.
And writers. TexFX. Yeah. Good.
Very cool. You mentioned MIT there. I don't want to slide over that. So you're still teaching?
Yes, yeah, still
rap
teaching.
Class?
Yep.
How's that going?
Great. I mean,
Professor
great.
Fiasco?
Yeah, I'm in three
what
departments.
What do they call you?
They call me Professor Fiasco.
Do they really?
Or Professor Lupe.
I thought I made that up.
Or Professor Jaco. You know, they'll do that too.
Yeah.
I've been going to MIT for about 6 years. Was part of the MLK program for 2 of those years. And now I'm like on faculty now for like the next 3 years.
So cool.
But they're trying to like keep me there. But there's other programs that are coming up. I'm at Yale as a Saybrook Fellow, and then there's a Johns Hopkins Peabody Conservatory program that is kind of coming into fruition. So
you are busy.
I'm in there.
Yeah. So you're heading south to Atlanta next, and you're going to wrap up the Samurai tour in late December.
Yeah.
Can you tease maybe what fans should look out for after the tour ends?
I'll be at school.
That's it? The music
I'll be
just
teaching. there's we've already started to book shows for the next year, you know. So we'll be coming to different spots.
Nice. That's what we want to hear.
Some international situations. So if you're international, if you listen to this somewhere in the world, we might be coming to you very soon. More music. I know we put out a special mixtape for the tour.
Okay.
You know, that people, you gotta be first 10 people in line and get one.
Mm-hmm.
So we're gonna do something with that. The Tetsu on Youth vinyl is out. I mean, that's a lot. Like how you said CRS, when I say Tetsu on Youth vinyl, fans are like, oh, that's the last album that didn't have vinyl. It took 10 years to make it. So that's out. People are enjoying that. Lupe Fiasco Day is a thing. I mean, also, which is really cool. And for me, this is like one of the reasons why, like, this is not like a flower. This is like another big step.
Okay.
The Rap Theory and Practice course, it started as like a special subject. Now it's like a permanent course at MIT.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Right? So it's like, yay, rap.
That's incredible. So even if you decide at some point to step aside, it
somebody
will keep
else
going.
Can come in and keep going. Right?
Love that.
So, yeah. So, you know, myriad things, of course. Diversity of things with Lupe.
We've been speaking with Chicago's own Lupe Fiasco. Check out his latest album, Samurai, available everywhere. Thank you for making the time, Lupe.
Thank you.
Such a pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Let's go out on a Lupe classic. Here's Kick Push.
What up, y'all? Yeah. Soundtrack, what's poppin', baby?
Woo!
If y'all ain't know, I go by the name of Lupe Fiasco, representing that first stand, 15.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Micah Yasin, Ethan Schwab, Mendy Kong, and me. It was edited by Meha Ahmed and mixed by Ethan. You can support the work we do on Reset by liking and subscribing to our podcast. We drop new episodes every weekday with a special one on Saturday. You can also sign up for our newsletter. Head to wbez.org/resetnews. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.
With a list like this. Now we can end the story right here. But shorty didn't quit. It was something in the air. Yeah, he said it was something so appealing. He couldn't fight the feeling. Something about it. He knew he couldn't doubt it. Couldn't understand it. Brand
branded. Since the first kickflip, he landed. Labeled a misfit, a bandit. Cocoon, cocoon, cocoon. His neighbors couldn't stand it, so he was banished to the park. Started in the morning, one stopped after dark. Yeah, when they said it's getting late in here. So I'm sorry, young man, there's no skating here. So we kick, push, kick.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.